Good morning to everybody. We're just about to start the class. And today we'll be taking up this past week's Parsha Vayechi, two points on there. And we'll just start momentarily. Any part of the class, we do post them online since we can hear the entire class. We put those at the audio link on the Masar website. And there you'll find archives for all previous classes as well. And again, we'll start just in about a moment. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good, good.
Good. Rivka and Josh are on with us, too.
Hey, Josh, how are you today?
Good morning, Rabbi.
Hi. Who's that?
Good morning, it's Rivka.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning, Josh. How are you doing?
Fine.
Hey, Josh, you had sent an email. I just caught it last night regarding if a person is living according to Noahide law, but they're not in a community, should they relocate to a community?
And you're saying I did?
No, I think it was Josh's question. Josh, was that you, or was it another? Maybe it was another Josh.
Yeah, well, this is Josh, yeah.
Oh, so maybe it was another Josh then.
Yeah, it must have been another one, because I didn't send that.
Oh, okay. My error. Okay, I'll have to take a look more carefully.
Did you just start?
We're just getting going. How are you doing, Naomi?
Hey, good.
Good. Okay, so I'll have to see who it is. Maybe I'll look too quickly at the email. All right, so we actually did something interesting yesterday on the Parsha, so I thought we'd take that up, and then we'll resume with Koheles next week, in God willing. So yesterday's Parsha, it opens up with, it's Parsha Vayechi, and it opens up with Jacob's request from Joseph that he swears to him that he will not bury him in Egypt. Because at this point already, Jacob and the tribes and all the 70 Jews that descended from Canaan were now living in Egypt, in the land of Goshen. And now that Jacob knew he was about to die, he did not want to be buried, for some reason, in Egypt. Okay, so the verse says, this is in Genesis 47:29. So in the days of Israel, which is also the second name for Jacob, drew close that he was going to die. So he called to his son Joseph, and he said to him, "If I found favor in your eyes, please place your hand under my thigh." I think one of the commentators says that that's an act of subservience, when you would put your hand and somebody would sit down on your hand. So in those days, so the person who's sitting on the hand is superior to the person whose hand is there underneath the thigh. So it's just a demonstration that the person would agree to the wishes, that one would take on the role of servant to the other person. So he said, you know, place your hand under my thigh. This is the way that we do it back then. And do for me a kindness of truth. Please do not bury me in Egypt. And the next verse says, and I will lie with my fathers, and then you will carry me from Egypt, and you'll bury me in their grave site. He's talking about the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. That was the site where Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Rebekah were buried. And so was Leah buried there. Some even say that Adam and Eve are buried there. So Joseph agrees, and he says, yes, I'll do as your words. And then Jacob says to him, swear to me. So he swore to him, and then Jacob bowed down on the head of the bed to his son for doing this. Okay. So the question is, what's so important here about being buried in that place, not being buried in Egypt? And I know that there's a Rashi. Rashi wants to say a couple of different views. That one view is that Jacob did not want to become an idol, to become deified in his death to, you know, the Egyptians or anybody else. And you see that also that God did not reveal the location of Moses' burial site because, you know, the people would have the tendency to, you know, rush to him, even in his death, to pray to him and so on and so forth. And you see that today. That's a very big practice today. There's nothing wrong with going to the grave site of a righteous person to recall their perfection and to inspire yourself. And actually, Torah law says you could even go to the grave site of a person who's not even Jewish, like, for example, on the days of mourning. So just to recall the concept of our own mortality. So going to a grave site is a very good thing. We don't see graves that much. And when we go there, it instills us again with that reminder that we are mortal, and it's a great assistance in terms of getting a person, you know, shocking him back onto the right path that he's not here forever, and you should recount what you're doing and reassess where you're putting your time and your values and your assumptions about what's important. And many times we just lose a hold of the realization that we are here temporarily, and that feeling of immortality moves us to sin. You see that was the punishment that God gave to Adam and Eve, that they would no longer. He said that the day that you eat from the fruit, you will certainly die. It doesn't mean you will drop dead on the moment, because you see they didn't die as soon as they ate, but they now became mortal, and that was necessary in order to temper their attachment to the physical world. Okay. So, getting back to our verse now, so what's so important here in Jacob's mind that, I mean, once he's dead, he's not there. He's not in his body anymore. Right? So I mean, that's an important thing to understand here. So what else can we say? And again, we're keeping Rashi in mind that he said he did not want to become deified in his death. That's very good. So you don't have to be buried in Egypt. You can be buried somewhere else. But there's also the point that he says, and again, and if you look at the verses always give the answer. And it's my assessment that this verse, 47:30, is really where we'll find the answer. So take a look for a moment. Oh, wait. Also, if there's any questions, let me know. How's it sound, okay?
Yeah, it sounds good, Rabbi.
Okay.
It strikes me that there's a phrase in here that could easily be missed in verse 3, and it's the first clause, and I will lie down with my fathers, and you shall transport me out of Egypt and bury me in their grave. Now, it could be, and you need to tell me, that lie down with my fathers is just a euphemism for I'm going to die.
Right.
And that's it. Then I'm on the wrong track. But why doesn't he just say, I'm going to die? Why does he want to lie down with my fathers? Is there something about the proximity of being near my people, even in death, that's very important?
Okay. Could be. I would say yes. That's why he's saying these words to him. Just as an important thing, since you brought it up, when we were discussing it yesterday, one of my friends had mentioned that there's another case where it states that first I'm going to lie with my fathers, which is how this verse starts, and then you'll move me. So that means the moving of my body is already, it's subsequent to the fact that I'm with my fathers, meaning my being with the fathers is something which is that, you know, my soul is now departed. So moving my body is not going to do anything to bring me close to my fathers. So that means Jacob is saying, my very joining of Abraham and Isaac is something which takes place regardless of my body's location. Right? So we're forced to say it's not, the moving of the body after that is not for Jacob. Right? Because he first says, when I die, that's it. My soul is now going to be, I'm going to be somehow, whatever that means, lying down with my fathers already, even before you transport my body. But nonetheless, you're right. There is something here that Jacob is saying that's important. And not only that, I'll strengthen what you're saying, Doug, because he says, I will lie down with my fathers, and you'll carry my body, right, you'll carry me from Mitzrayim, from Egypt, and you'll bury me in there. Gravesite. Right? So he refers to the fathers twice in this verse. I will lie down with my fathers, and you'll bury me in their gravesite. So we see this, it's referred to twice. Why can't he be in his own gravesite? Or if he didn't want to be deified in death, so put him somewhere else. But you see that this very gravesite of the forefathers was something which is an institution of sorts, because Abraham buried Sarah there, and then he desired to be buried there as well. And Isaac and Rebekah also said, we have to be buried here as well. And Jacob also understood something about this location. It's a real phenomenon. We just accept it as part of, you know, Jewish culture. But you have to stop and ask, what was the idea that Abraham initiated with this gravesite of the patriarchs and matriarchs? What's going on there? What is so essential? And Jacob says, no, I have to be buried there too.
And is it that site, or is it I need to be buried near my forefathers?
Right, exactly. The latter.
Yeah.
Or you could also say that it was in Israel too. But to say that this parcel of land in Israel is supposed to be another parcel, yeah, I don't think you have to go that far. I don't think that there's any justification for that. You could say there's two elements, that there's with the forefathers, and also that it was in Israel. I want to take the first one, though, to address, what do you mean with my forefathers? When I lie with my fathers, and then you should bury me in their sight. I think that's an important statement he's making. So, as I always suggest, is that if we can't get an answer to something based on the direct question in terms of the subject matter, so what I feel is very helpful is to ask it in the reverse. And I'll give you an example. If I can't find, you know, in my mind a clear definition for, let's say, you know, what is a door? Everybody uses a door every day, but if I want to sit down and think, I want to give a real, the best definition for a door. And I just am grappling with it, and I can't think, you know, what is it? It's a structure. Yeah, a wall is also a structure. You know, you can go in and out of your house with it. Well, you can do the same thing with a window. So how do I define a door to give it a definition that is exclusive to it and nothing else? So that's really when you're defining something, is when your definition will only fit the topic at hand and nothing else. Then you know you have defined something properly, because now you've described its exclusive nature. So if I can't describe the exclusive nature of something, I'm just having a hard time with it, like a door. So then I ask myself the reverse. Well, what would I be lacking if I didn't have a door? Now, a lot of times when we do that, a contrast comes to mind that will help us really see clearly what we're missing. And it brings us closer to the definition. So if we don't have a door in a structure, so then there's really no ease of access. It's true, we could use a window too, but the door is the most easy in terms of it's the right height and width for a person, and it's got an opening that goes flush to the ground, whereas a window, the opening doesn't go flush to the ground. So you have to, it's uncomfortable, you have to raise your leg very high or jump up sometimes to get through a window. But a door is very easy. So it's something which is, it's defined as ease of entry. So that's what I'm lacking. So if I think about what am I missing if I don't have a door in a structure, well, I can't get in and out easily. Oh, so now I've arrived at my definition by asking the question in the reverse. Meaning if I invert the topic, it sometimes brings me closer to it. For example, again, a person may ask, well, how do I define water? Well, a person may have a hard time. They don't know which way am I supposed to define it. So then, well, what would you be lacking if you didn't have water? Oh, I'd be thirsty and things wouldn't grow. Very good. That brings us to the real definition. So we can do the same thing over here. Jacob is saying that I should be buried with my forefathers. Okay. If we can't figure out what he really feels the necessity is, like, what we feel, excuse me, if we can't figure out what the real definition of that phenomena of the cave of the patriarchs and the matriarchs, the burial site. So we can ask the question in the inverse. We can say, well, what would be lacking if Jacob was not buried with them and buried by himself? Let's take the question that way. See if that brings to mind anything more.
Rabbi, it seems like there either would have to be a benefit. Yeah, there's obviously some benefit to him to be buried with his forefathers, or there is a benefit.
Right, good.
That
was a good move.
Sorry. You go ahead.
No, that was a good move you just made. You said a benefit to him, but then you stopped and you said, no, there's a benefit.
Right, and the benefit, it seems like, either has to be to him or to someone else.
Right.
Now, if it were a benefit to him, then there would have to be some almost magical thing that happens after you're dead if you're buried close to, you know, someone else of great stature, like it rubs off on you or something like that, and I'm not aware of any doctrine or approach that takes that position.
That's right, because there is none.
Right. So that would mean the benefit would have to be for someone else.
Good. Who?
And the question is, who's the someone else? And I would have to say all of Jacob's posterity, all the people who are left over who are alive.
Right. I would say everybody, not just his posterity, but any human being.
And the only thing then that I could come to mind, and I don't feel it's fully developed yet, is that there is some advantage to having the sort of physical tradition of this lineage of people all buried in a common place, so that the focus of where the traditions and the history of the Jewish people come from, they can look to a particular place and not have that be scattered all over the globe. And I don't feel like that's on target or a full answer yet, but that's the only thing I can come up with at this point.
Okay, good. Okay, anybody else? Let's see if anybody else wants to...
Well, I don't think this is what Jacob had in mind, but I know they say that, like, the dead, you know, in that Tiatam 18, the days of the Mashiach, that people are not buried and they have to say, like, going to roll through the ground or something.
Okay, that doesn't answer the question, though, right?
Yeah, but I was just making a point because, you know, you were saying that there's no benefit... The person, no, I don't think that's why Jacob wanted to be buried there, but, I mean, I know, like, they say that there is a benefit to the person, is what I'm saying.
Well, according to that, he should be buried right under the temple, because then you have to travel nowhere. Yeah, because I know there's that Rashi that says that, you know, people roll underground caverns. It doesn't sound to me that it makes any sense, you know, literally. It means that the further away you're... You're buried from Israel, so the more of a problem you might experience at the times of the Messiah's arrival. So you could describe the problem as being that you're gonna have to roll through a lot of distance underground until you get there. That doesn't really make sense because I don't see what God would do with that. But what you could say is that if a person the more removed he is from the value of Israel, so the more of a perfection he may have to go through when the time is of the Messiah, and that could be euphemistically described as he'll have to travel a little difficult journey, which, you know, that's the metaphor, but the real underlying idea is that if a person doesn't bury himself in Israel and he buries himself outside of Israel, so that means he's lacking certain values. So those values will then have to be perfected at the times of the Messiah. So you can say that safely. You hear what I'm saying, Naomi?
Yeah, good. Rabbi?
Yes?
It seems like this has to do with identification in the sense that when Abraham first purchased the cave and the land there, you wouldn't just purchase a cave and have maybe one or two people buried there. It sounds like it was set up as that this would be a family place, you know, of identification. And when we say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it solidifies or identifies the family and what they stood for.
So that when people would go there, they would be reminded of all the teachings and the things that those lives stood for.
So you would see the burial spot of these three people that had certain ideas.
Right. It would remind you about those ideas.
And in a sense, the commitment to those ideas, because it would have been really easy for Jacob to just be buried in Egypt, but given the whole philosophy and what Egypt stood for was an idolatrous way of life, and his commitment to don't leave me here, I don't want to be identified with this, I want to be identified with my father and, you know, my grandfather, and it solidified that.
Well, his identification would only be while he's alive.
Well, I wouldn't see it that way.
His personal identification in terms of him, because after he's dead, then that's the case. But what about all his...
Oh, the Jewish nation.
Yeah, all the people that come after him.
Right. Okay. Right, I agree. You're saying that he shared something with them. That's what being buried with them means.
Right.
Okay. The only problem you have with that is if you're telling me that he has to be buried with them to show that he shared it, well, what? Let's say we're just looking at the time of when Abraham just died. So now only he and Sarah are in this plot because Rebecca and Isaac are still alive. Now, you don't need anybody else to compliment Abraham and Sarah, right? And you still understand the lifestyle that he has. So even without being joined with other people, you can still reflect on the person's perfection. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
So then that would be a conflict of what you're saying, that Jacob would have to be buried with them in order to demonstrate it. Because you see that Abraham alone could demonstrate the right lifestyle without being buried with anybody else.
Yes, but there's strength, he could, but there's strength in essentially giving a message that says, I attach myself so strongly to the philosophy of Abraham, and that's what my life is about, that I want to be buried near that guy.
All right. Okay, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I think there's another way we can say this, and there's another element to it as well. And that's as follows, that if a person is buried by himself, so then when another person who's alive comes to a site, so then it's the personality that emerges from that location, from that gravesite. If, however, it's not an individual that's buried here, but there's three pairs of progenitors of the Jewish people that are buried here, so now what emerges is not an individual person, because there's three or four couples, according to some, even Adam and Eve were buried there. But what now happens is that the individual is obscured by the group. And now what emerges from the site is now a theme of lifestyle, which is basically what you were saying. But what happens is that when you have a number of people that follow the same path, so now the lifestyle is what emerges from here. Because the person who visits the gravesite understands that there's a commonality between why these three groups of people, why are they all buried together with nobody else? So that is something which is unavoidable, and that's what hits the person when they come there. That these three groups of people, yes, I know they have individual personalities. However, what happens, what emerges, is that the theme of their lives is really what overtakes the person. You see?
Yeah.
And Rabbi, to take off from that too, is the qualities of each of those individuals. All of those qualities come together to enhance the demonstration of what Torah and Judaism teaches. Each one individually wouldn't be as complete.
I don't know about complete, but it definitely is the element that there's a movement. One person is not, so that's another facet too, is that one person is not a movement. But the fact that there's a group and that there's three generations succeeding and from the same line, that also is an important thing. And that's what it seems to be with the plan was, that See, it wasn't for them. It wasn't for the patriarchs. They want, they're concerned about the people even after they were dead. They wanted in death, too, that they should have give a lesson to the people. So that was really Jacob's concern, and that he wanted to be in his, that's what it says, his forefathers. If you look at the verse, he says that I should sleep with my fathers, and you'll bear me in their sight. Meaning it's them that's important, not me. It's the group. I think that's what's being borne out from that verse, Genesis 47:30. You should bury me in their place. Death is not about me. Death is about what we can do with that. But in some cases, a site, like for example when Moses is buried, the greatest leader and the greatest prophet, so people had a very big attachment to him in terms of being so close to God, there would be a danger. Because people have the tendency to look to the dead as being some sort of intermediary. Or even effective, even after the dead. But that's against Torah. The Torah says we don't consult the dead. We can take inspiration from them. And even when Caleb, you know, the story with the 12 spies, so it says they went here and they went there, and then it says he came to Hebron. So on the spot, the rabbis say, what do you mean he came? There's a group of 12. It should say they came to Hebron. Meaning when they're discussing the travels of the spies as they're doing a reconnaissance mission on the land of Israel before they went in for the first time. But it says he came to tell you an idea that only one person went to Hebron. Who was that one person? That was Caleb, they said, because he wanted to go to the gravesite of the patriarchs, meaning this very place we're talking about, and he would be inspired by them. Meaning to say, Caleb recognized in himself he's a human being. And the council of the 11, of the 10 evil spies, because Joshua and Caleb were committed to the truth. They didn't deny God's ability. But the other 10 spies were insecure. They didn't feel they could take over the land, even though God said they could. So they sinned by bringing back fruits and trumping. They did what Moses told them to bring back the fruits, but then they trumped up charges against the land. Caleb knew that they requested to seek out the land first, even though God didn't tell them to do this. They were just told to go in and conquer. The very fact that they approached Moses and they wanted to look into land first and assess it, that showed that they were insecure and they already questioned God. Caleb knew this, and therefore he knew they were going to try to convince him to go onto their side. So he wanted to bolster his emotional conviction. So what did he do? He went to the place of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. Why did he go there of all places? Because they're the ones that God initiated his promise about Israel. So by going to the very place and contemplating these people's lives that God initiated this promise about Israel, that solidified in his mind and in his heart a conviction that he knew would then be unshakable when he went back together with the other spies and they came back to the Jews that were waiting on the other side of the Jordan. But he was honest. He recognized that these 10 evil spies can be very persuasive, and he needed to really strengthen himself emotionally, so he went there. That's why it says he went, not they went. He went alone to the grave of the patriarchs and the matriarchs. And he looked at the grave, and he said, as real as it is to my eyes, and I see that their burial spot, so that reminds me of how real God's promise is that we will get the land, and we don't need to worry about that at all. And then he was able to stand up to the spies and try to redirect the people towards Moses and follow Moses. He wasn't successful, but he was wise in what he did. But the Talmud actually talks about this and says that he spread himself out on the grave, sort of like prostrating himself. So the rabbis are concerned that you're not allowed to consult the dead. So what was Caleb doing? So Tosfos is one of the greatest commentaries on the Talmud, says that he prayed to God. That Caleb was praying to God, and God would deliver his message to the patriarchs. Not that Caleb prayed to the dead people himself. So you see that the Talmud gets you out of that problem.
Why would he pray to God and ask them to deliver a message to the patriarchs if the patriarchs are dead?
Well, they're dead to us, but their souls exist. So for some reason, according to Tosfos, Caleb saw that praying to God, that God should now deliver this to the matriarchs and patriarchs that had passed. Somehow he felt that would be a help to Caleb, that he knew that they would now be recognizing, maybe to Caleb, that now just brought just the prayer itself to God. And in his prayer, he talks about these patriarchs in the sense that they're very much alive. So that is something which was reassuring to him. Meaning, you don't pray to anybody else except for God. He's not asking God to tell the patriarchs to do something. He was basically, in other words, the way the rabbis said it in the midrashic, the homiletic expression in the Talmud, they said that Caleb said to the forefathers that they should save him from the council of the spies, right? That they should guard him or something. So it sounds as if he's talking straight to the dead forefathers, but we know he couldn't do that because that is something which is prohibited, to talk to the dead. So the rabbis also assumed that an observant Jew reading this would of course understand this to be a homily. It'd be a metaphor. Unfortunately, many people take these things literally, and that's where the problems start. What the rabbis were saying was, in a homiletic expression, that Caleb was going to this place in order to derive inspiration from the existence of the patriarchs. That's all it means. And Tosfos goes one step further and says that since, you know, the rabbis did coin the homiletic expression as if he's talking to the dead patriarchs, so Tosfos wants to get out of any problems. Say, no, he didn't talk to them, because that would be prohibited. He also says, because there's a verse in Ecclesiastes, in Kohelis, that we're doing there, that says the dead don't know anything. There's also, you know, rabbinical statements on that too. So, but again, the verse itself has to be taken on, it has to be the plain expression of any verse has to make sense. So if the plain expression of the verse says the dead don't know anything, that means to say that there's a barrier between the dead and what's happening on earth. So then that would now cause any type of talking to the dead to be unjustified, you know, based on the plain explanation of the verse. Okay, but the simple explanation is that Caleb went there to identify with these people because they were the ones that God initiated the promise of Israel. So now that bolsters his spirit, and now he'll be able to stand up against the spies who questioned whether they can really take over the land or not. Now Caleb was sure that we can, because God said so. He said to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and now we're going to go in, and finally God's going to fulfill the promise to us. So that's why he went. So you see that the actual intent of Jacob here in our Torah section really had a fulfillment in Caleb's action, you know, many years later, that it was used for the right reason, that people should go there and draw inspiration from the perfection of their lives. But again, it's the collective theme of their life which is important. It's not the individual. So don't look at us as personalities. Look at the shared values that we have, and the shared values only emerges when you have a number of people buried in one spot. So now it shows you that there's a movement here, there's a transmission of a system, and that's what the patriarchs and matriarchs collectively desired to portray even after their death, that they should still serve as a lesson. Okay. We're good. Any questions?
Yes, Rabbi. May I ask?
Yeah, please. Go ahead.
No? Yeah. May I ask, please? So basically, if one goes to the cemetery of the great ones, as I kind of had done, this was to gain strength, not to ask them to pray for him. So he should gain strength by being in close proximity of the great ones. Is that true?
Right, by looking at the grave of a person, there's a lot of lessons. One is to reflect on the perfection if the person who passed away is a perfect person. Or even if a person was nothing great in his life, but a person could also derive a lesson about his mortality by going to the grave.
Right, okay. But in other words, it's an endeavor to go to ask them to pray for
yes.
us.
Yeah, we only pray to God.
That's right. Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, anybody else? Everything clear?
Right now, with burial, is it in Israel? Is it like in controlled by Israel or by the Arabs?
Oh, I don't know. I believe it still is controlled by the Jews.
I was looking at, I guess the other times this is mentioned here. Yeah, in 49:29, Jacob tells again. I think maybe here he's talking to
his other sons.
Yeah, all the other sons, and he gives more of a description of the cave. And then I thought this was interesting. Maybe as learned something of Joseph's wisdom of psychology here. In 50, first few verses there in chapter 50, Joseph is telling this to Pharaoh's household, and he words it kind of differently. Says, my father had adjured me, saying, behold, I'm about to die. In my grave, which I have hewn for myself in the land of Canaan, there you are to bury me.
Yeah, that is a good observation.
Which seems, you know, it's not what he was quoted as saying earlier.
Right, here he's not, he knows that won't be the lesson, that Paro won't take, you know, there won't be anything important really. It won't resonate with Paro that Jacob's grandfather and father are buried there. That's something which Jacob communicates to Joseph, because Joseph appreciates what he's trying to do. Paro is not of their culture, so saying that he should be buried where his father and his grandfather are, that's not the issue. But what will affect Paro is that it's his own gravesite that he has secured for himself.
Yeah. And too, he doesn't say it directly to Pharaoh. He says he spoke to Pharaoh's household, and he tells them, speak now in the ears of Pharaoh. I mean, so I don't know.
Right.
Not sure why he couldn't just say it directly to Pharaoh.
Yeah, Rabbi Chait had a very interesting point on that. Because in the past, he spoke directly to Pharaoh. Now he has to speak to the house of Pharaoh. So Rabbi Chait wanted to show from here is that you see that there was a power struggle as time went on between Joseph and Paro. And there was a removal of Joseph's accessibility to Paro because of that. So now he only communicates through his household. So evidently there was some, maybe already the seeds of Paro completely dismissing Joseph have begun. Because you see that in this coming, you know, Parsha, where it says that there was a new king that did not know Joseph. Right? That's what it says in the beginning of Exodus.
Alright.
Okay. Where is it? Yeah, that's in Exodus 1:8. And there arose a new king in Egypt that did not know Joseph. So it's odd. The one who was the savior of Egypt, the next king's not going to even know. So one of the rabbis say that it was literally a new king. Another rabbi says no. It was the same Paro, but he changed his decrees. Rabbi Chait gave a whole class on it explaining why. And he said, you see, it fits very good in terms of Paro's initial overwhelming response to Joseph and making him a viceroy. 2 seconds earlier, he was a Hebrew slave in prison, accused of rape, and now he makes him into a viceroy? I mean, it seems a little bit, it's too much. Rabbi Chait explained beautifully that Paro was so debilitated because he felt inadequate. What's going to happen? Now there's a famine. I don't know what to do. And his ego was completely depleted. But then when he saw this, Joseph had a plan of how he can be successful. Even not only can we address the famine, but we can come out ahead. So this was something which, by identifying with Joseph as being part of him, and together Joseph and I will rule. That's why the king, that Paro said, only in the throne will I be greater than you. Meaning just in terms of title. But in every other way, we are teaming, we are partners, we're together. And that helped to replenish Paro's sense of self, his ego. That's why he made him into his viceroy right away. Because psychologically, he was desperate for this. His sense of self. And that's why he also dreamt that he was standing on the Nile River. He was above the god of Egypt in his dream when those cows came out. Again, because he had this need to be superior. And that's usually what drives a person to levels of power. They want that. That really gives them a sense of self. But now what happens after Joseph dies? What's going to happen to that very same Paro? He's now going to be crippled because that very person that gave him that sense of self, that supplanted, you know, that supported his ego, his very self-image, he needed Joseph. And now Joseph's dead. The only way he could now survive psychologically is if he denies the whole era of Joseph. So that's what the rabbi was saying, that a new king arose that did not know Joseph. Meaning it was the same Paro, but he made this whole event out to be a nothing. It's like he never existed, because he couldn't tolerate the fact that what the person he needs is now gone. So he just completely represses the whole thing. Very, very good insight that Rabbi Chay gave.
I have a question. Why do you need to go beyond the verse where it says it's a new pair? Why wouldn't you just accept the meaning, you know?
Because why wouldn't the new king know about Joseph? He was the most prominent figure in Egypt. How could you not know this Joseph? The verse says that.
Oh, that makes sense. You know, like there's something, because it doesn't make sense, so there's something behind it.
Yeah, there's something which is really problematic. They were trying to explain that problem. Yeah.
Yeah, if that is the case, I would think it would be very possible that the Pharaoh would have, you know, any records, you know, monuments and that sort of thing destroyed also, if he was trying to totally blot out, you know, that that ever happened.
It could be he did. Yeah, it's an open
question. It's kind of speculation, but...
Yeah, Rashi says it openly. On the words that did not know Joseph, he made himself as if he didn't know him. So you see, Rashi is bothered by the words. What do you mean he didn't know Joseph? How could that be? So it's calling your attention to that. It seems to be an impossibility in terms of a historical assessment. You can't say you didn't know the previous person that was responsible for the greatest good that ever happened to this country. So the verses raise the question and they answer them too. That's the real method of the Torah. Okay, are we good? Any other questions?
I think we're good.
Okay. Now let me say one more thing, which I heard in the name of Rabbi Besser. Rabbi Besser is an elderly rabbi in New York City. This is maybe going back 10 years, maybe more. And I happen to have been there, you know, this time of the year. And so I was asking him a question about the crossing of the hands. When Jacob crossed his hands over Joseph's two sons, and when he was about to bless them. So he said a very interesting thing, because you don't see that he, you know, Isaac doesn't put his hands out on top of, you know, Esau's head. I mean, it was really Jacob at the time, but he thought it was Esau. He didn't put his hands out, and when Jacob is blessing his 12 sons, you don't see him putting his hands out on the head. So what is this phenomenon that Jacob puts his hands on the heads of Manasseh and Ephraim, but he crosses them, and he puts his right hand, which is always to represent more preference or the greater one, he put his right hand on the younger son, which the verses say would disturb Joseph, because Joseph was saying, no, move your hand, because your right hand should be on the older son. So, you know, Jacob says, no, I understand, my son, but he your older son will be great, but the younger is going to be even greater. But the question is, why put your hands on the head? So Rabbi Besser said an interesting thing. He said that Abraham had two children, Yishmael and Isaac, and they were at odds with each other. And that's why Sarah said that you have to send away Hagar and Ishmael, because he's going to be a bad influence. Isaac himself had two sons, Jacob and Esav, and they were at odds with each other. And Jacob himself had 12 sons, and they were at odds with Joseph. So throughout time, there was this sibling rivalry. There was this conflict between the children. So Rabbi Besser said, now Jacob wanted to determine, is this continuing on in Joseph's children? So he made it a display. He could have just given the blessings, but he wanted to make a display of preference to the younger to see if the older is going to, you know, make a fuss. And he didn't. And because of that, because these children were finally perfected and Joseph raised them in a way where there wasn't any type of jealousy, it didn't matter to the older one that the younger was now going to be with a greater blessing. When, you know, Jacob saw this, he said, this is how you know, Israel will bless their children. Because this is now the right way, the way children should be, where there isn't this rivalry and they're raised properly. So he had to put his hands out to make a display to the children. This was not necessary in other cases. Interesting point. I just wanted to share that, since that's also in the same you know, segment of the Torah that we're in right now. Because the hands are really not necessary for blessing.
So the idea is that the older will not care that, or the younger will not care that the older is getting a bigger portion.
No, the opposite. The older one won't care that the younger one is getting a better blessing. Because typically the older is more of a preference. He's the leader in the household.
Right, but speaking generically, not in this example, but generally what Jacob is saying is that it shouldn't matter at all.
Yes.
Downstream, okay.
Right, there should be, you know, a real appreciation for the person. Whatever they get, they get. Don't be jealous that, you know, somebody else is better off than you. Be happy with your lot. That's what the rabbis say. The wealthy person is the person who is satisfied with his lot.
Right, that's a wonderful explanation.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so we have a little time left. Is there any other questions? We can take up a few other, you know, points if you have any, even if it's not on the topic.
Rabbi, I'm kind of sticking to the same topic that you were just covering. When you mentioned about placing the hand upon the head and giving a blessing, isn't that a custom on the Jews for Shabbat, for the father to say that blessing?
It could be. It could be it became. I'm just saying that it's not necessary. The blessing is not something which is... see, what is a blessing? A blessing, if you look at the verses, I think Rabbi Chaim talked about this years ago, that when Jacob was blessing his 12 sons, he's really talking about their personalities. And he talks to you know, Simon and Levi, who destroyed the city of Shechem, and he says, your anger is cursed. What type of blessing is that? Meaning, a blessing is where you, and it's a very interesting statement. It's a very telling statement that it said that he blessed them, each one in accordance with his blessing. Well, what do you mean in accordance with his blessing? You mean before they came before their father Jacob, they had a blessing, and now Jacob blessed them in accordance with that blessing? That doesn't make sense. He didn't give the blessing yet. What do you mean, each one he blessed in accordance with his blessing? So it must mean, what does it mean, Jacob blessed each son in accordance with his blessing? It has to be explained. He blessed each one in accordance with his nature. So, the bracha, it's an interesting thing. I'm not sure if I'm correct on this or not, but the word bracha, you also have, it also refers to the knees. Ber Chaim, it says in the verse that when Jacob brought out his two sons when Joseph brought out his two sons in front of Jacob, it says he brought them out from between his knees. You look at the word for knees, and it has the same root, Ber Chaim, it says, from between his knees. Let's see. Yibirchov. It's Genesis 48:12. And Joseph brought them out, his two sons, Me'im Birkov. I guess he was holding them between his knees and before Joseph. So what does knees have to do with the same thing as blessing? Right? And also Rach, the two second letters in the word bracha means like soft or maybe weak. And the knees are something which, when a person gets weak, his knees bend. So perhaps bracha, the word in Hebrew, which has the same root as knees and soft and bend, means bracha means the softness of the person, the vulnerabilities or the tendencies of the person, perhaps. So that's why it's the same word. That when it says he blessed them in accordance with their blessing, I mean, he blessed them, he spoke about them, he addressed those parts of their personality that were unique to each one. He described, whether it was for good or whether it was for bad, Jacob was now, before he was about to die, was pointing out elements in his sons. Work on this, or strengthen this area, or capitalize on this good quality that you have. So that's really what the blessings were, where he described what their personalities, and Reuben, he was too impulsive, he says. You're impulsive like water. You just like spilled it quickly, you acted. Like water rushes forth. So to his point, he was talking about an event where after Rachel died, so I think Jacob had moved his bed into the concubine of Rachel. Really, Reuben thought you should have moved your bed into Leah, into her tent. So he did that. But he acted impulsively. So because of that, when that was part of the blessing that Jacob was giving to Reuben, he was pointing out a certain part of his nature, that he should work on it. So that was really what bracha is, what blessing is. So blessing is not that he can cause anything. Only God causes change in the universe. But what a person can do for his sons is just point out certain traits. So why didn't Jacob do that with Menashe and Ephraim? The answer is very simple. You see that when he first saw Menashe and Ephraim, Joseph's two sons, he says, who are these? That means that was the first time he ever met them. So the first time he ever met Menashe and Ephraim, he doesn't have any experience with the personalities. He can't possibly say anything about them in terms of pointing out their pluses or minuses. All he can do is talk about what he knows in terms of prophecy, that one will be greater than the other. But he can't give the assessment of their personalities that he was able to do with his 12 sons who he raised. So that's why it was a different statement that Jacob made for Menashe and Ephraim than he made in connection with his own sons. With connection with his own sons, he had experience. So he was able to point out to them, here's a good quality, capitalize on it. Here's a bad quality, work on it and remove it. But in terms of Menashe and Ephraim, who we never met before, there he couldn't do that possibly. So therefore, he just addressed what he knew perfectly, it was true, that the younger would be greater. And he used his hands to try to evoke any jealousy. He saw that wasn't there. And he says that this is now how they should, what does it say? It says, It even repeats that. It says, yeah, and he blessed him on that day. He says, "Becha yivarech Yisrael." In you, in these, will the Jews bless, saying, "God should place you like Ephraim and like Manasseh." And then the verse ends. That's 48:20, and he placed the younger one, Ephraim, before Manasseh. The Torah repeats that in order to show you that that's what he was really doing. He was placing. He was doing an act of verbally communicating to the sons that I'm making the younger greater than the older, and there wasn't any type of animosity. So therefore, this is how Israel should bless their children. You should be like these, that they work together, that there's no animosity. Okay. And the fact is also that he made them like one of the 12 tribes. Manasseh and Ephraim became on the same level. Even though they were the next generation down, he made them on the same level as the rest of his 12 sons. So there's no tribe of Joseph. Joseph was doubled. It was split into Manasseh and Ephraim. Perhaps because of that perfection.
Let me bless Joseph again on his deathbed, and he didn't bless Manasseh and Ephraim.
Right, where's that?
I mean, didn't he at the end when he...
So no, he says that. He says, "I will split you in Israel."
He blessed Joseph.
Yeah, but he says, he refers to them there. He says, "I will split you in Israel." I believe he says, right? Binyamin. No, I'm sorry, maybe there was a mistake. Maybe he split Levi and Simon. Means that they should be together. Yeah, that was by Simon and Levi, right. He split them, so they shouldn't be together because they were they were destructive together. You're right, so he gives Joseph his own blessing later on. Right, so that's okay, because here he's talking about pointing at the good factors and the negative factors in his 12 sons. So this is not the place to talk about Manasseh and Ephraim. All right, Naomi?
Good, yeah.
Okay, so it makes sense that Manasseh and Ephraim are not there. Because actually, it's because of what we said. That was where he was addressing the children that he knew their personalities from youth. So Manasseh and Ephraim, he didn't. Okay, any other questions?
I think we're good.
Okay. All right, so God willing, next week we will resume with Kohelis. I think we're in chapter 2, so we'll pick up from there this coming Sunday. All right?
All right. That sounds good.
Okay.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Okay, my pleasure. All right, so have a good week to everybody.
Thanks so much, Rabbi. You too.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Be well.
Be well.